bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
I'm sorry, let me take off my Damon Lindelof number one fan hat. I'm just going to sit it right over here. There we go.
What are you doing?
That's right. Come at me. At me. Go ahead. Twitter.com/Wood.
Justin Robert Young.
Send him an email. He loves emails. He gets back to him.
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hey, everybody. That's me. Hi.
And we have a special guest today. We've had him on before on After Things, and this is Mr. Brian Thomas Schmidt, who is Brian has been an editor, a writer of science fiction fantasy for a number of years. Brian was one of the editors who worked on the Martian. Recently, he did the Predator anthology series, If It Bleeds. And right now, he has the book out, Simon Says, which is a sci-fi thriller.
Hey, look, Brian, at that. You have a copy. Awesome.
Of course I need a copy. Of course, I support my friends, you know. You know, if Schwed ever wrote a book, I'll order.
Man, I am so good at starting books. I have so many ideas.
Dude, that's how it starts.
So he used to write a Watchmen book. No, yeah. I'm just kidding. Anyway.
So, Mr. Brian Thomas Schmidt, it's great that you're here because, you know what this is? This month is?
November?
November 2019. Blade Runner is real. This is when Blade Runner
took place. Oh, yes, that's right. I was reading about the things we don't have and the things we do. I want my flying car. I'm close. I've ridden in Andrew's Tesla, but I haven't quite gotten to a flying car yet.
Thankfully it didn't fly. So kind of cool. It's 2019, and you know, we don't have the complete urban decay. I mean, unless you live, you know, where Justin does, or you know, close to some of the areas near me.
By the way, trust me, I wish that that those areas had the available street food that they have in Blade Runner. That would be a tremendous upgrade.
If I had to choose between replicants and cell phones, I'd rather live in the world with cell phones, because how do you have replicants but no cell phones?
Yeah, you remember they had expensive payphones with like crappy Skype images, you know. It is. That was a remarkable movie back in the day. The vision of the future felt like a very real, lived in kind of future, and it's incredible. And
I'm pinching all of this from articles I've read before, but it was also one of the first libertarian representations of the future. You know, in a world before Snow Crash, you had these beautifully architected worlds, your Star Trek utopias, where everything was centrally planned. But then that was my first depiction of just an utterly chaotic mishmash of different cultures that I thought, I'm kind of thrilled that that's eventually what the internet became, is like you're constantly bumping into all kinds of different, not only nationalistic cultures or racial cultures, but also social structures of you know, these little sub-meme cultures.
For the whole non-judicial murder of people who you just consider non-humans or actually human.
Now, wait a minute, though. So what if Blade Runner did not maybe fully accurately predict our real world, but I like where Brian's going. What if it absolutely predicted the internet? Because we have everything there. We have replicants. We have artificial creatures that have their own kind of a will, at least on some level. We have botnets that certainly affect our lives in certain kind of ways. We have people that hunt after them and track them. We have biases against them. They affect our culture and politics. Like, there is.
Holy cow, I think you're blowing my mind. Well, you're 100% right, because we do. It's like what's funny is I'm feeling my own biases. I'm like, yeah, man, destroy all them bots. They don't get to vote. They don't even get to talk. Kill them all.
The unique thing that I liked a lot about Blade Runner at the time, and even more as I look back, is, you know, we had so many depictions of the future that were very idealistic. This was a kind of a depressing, dark vision of the future. It wasn't all hopeful, and everything wasn't necessarily going to work out great. You know, I mean, even with the heroes, they weren't necessarily, they might fix a problem, but they weren't, you know, hey, we saved the day and now the world will be a better place. It wasn't that kind of story, which I think actually, you know, is a lot more like the world is right now for us than we probably want to admit. And, you know, I think that matches modern sentiment more than it did at the time.
Well, there, you know, there, it did come out of sort of this trend on late 60s, on 70s, on forward, the dystopian sort of future, you know, because you look back at Soylent Green, a lot of stuff where it's harder actually to find a positive view of the future. You go to like 2001, which was, you know, you had, you know, the Soviet and America tensions and stuff, but still the sort of explorative theory sort of thing. But I certainly loved it because of the visual. I liked that, you know, they got like Sid Mead and just these great visual artists on it. But, you know, it's interesting. So I think what I like about it is everybody sees it and can kind of have a different take from Blade Runner. Because, like, well, I remember as a kid watching this, and at first I'm like, they're robots. And then I'm like, oh no, they're people. They're because they have genes. They have all this stuff. I'm like, oh my God, this is about racism because, you know, they're not robot. They use the term robot, but a way to sort of, dehumanize them. And that was my takeaway. But it certainly is this just as valid, I guess, anybody else watching it. So,
well, I contrast it with, for example, you know, there was Battlestar Galactica, there was Buck Rogers, there was Star Wars, all of which, in my opinion, were a lot more idealistic views of the future in some ways because of the way the heroes were, you know, succeeding. Mm-hmm. Blade Runner, I mean, you didn't really get the sense that Deckard was just doing his job and, you know, he was fighting against pretty bad odds. But there was no winner in the sense of, you know, Luke Skywalker blew up the Death Star or anything like that, you know. Mm-hmm. Or there was no sense that the world was going to be better afterwards. Whereas when, you know, Star Wars and some of those others tended to have kind of that, we're gonna, you know, they're going to triumph and get the world better kind of theme, you know.
Well, because I think, and this is, we often talk about this with the Marvel movies, that the Marvel movies are really good because they're not superhero movies. They are about superheroes, but many of them take stories and elements of other kinds of movies. So they are war movies, they are heist movies, they are all these different sort of genres. And ultimately, what I think makes Blade Runner a classic is that it's a whodunit. It is a detective story, very much.
It is a noir.
Very much in this kind of Maltese Falcon-esque thing. That by the end of it, you know, if you look at some of those great detective stories, when you unravel or a movie like Chinatown or something like that, the end of it isn't a pot of gold. It's like when you chase after a very human secret, you find out there's something very screwed up at the end of it. And then when you finally pull back that curtain, you're like, oh God. Yeah. Makes a lot of sense that you kept that secret. That's awful. Like, I'm glad.
Exactly. And that's what I mean by the darker sense of it that contrasted to me what else I would seen at the time. So, I mean, back in the '80s, you know,
So let's go. What's one thing from Blade Runner you wish we had?
Another 30 years of Edward James Olmos.
Yeah, I was literally going to say, like, Edward James Olmos' weird accent. I really wish I had that.
It is remarkable how many things just seem dumb. Like, I remember even as a kid thinking that the lady walking around with the clear umbrella with a fluorescent tube handle, like, well, that's the dumbest thing ever. And here we live in a world where that would be totally unremarkable.
Yeah. In the world of selfie sticks, we've had to reassess everything that's dumb. Like,
wait, congratulations. We actually live in that world.
Yeah. And Bryce just found on Amazon the Blade Runner style glow LED style umbrella, and it's only $35. And oh my God.
Yeah. Amazing. And they can get there by the end of the week. That you can have to deliver. It's great.
Is there free Prime shipping? Because that's important. You know, that's a
sure. You know, one of the things that was casually mentioned in there, but was a thing that was throughout there, was they kept talking about like going off world and off world and the idea that LA and this part of the earth had sort of become just sort of like some dirty old sort of place where people sort of were left behind, where everybody else went off to the frontiers. And this, they brought this up in Blade Runner 2049, where, you know, you understand that actually out there among the stars is where the cool stuff is and the gleaming cities and the modern sort of world is. And I like the idea of like, well, what's the rest of the universe like, or what's the rest of this like?
Well, and that is another one of those elements of those noir stories, is that, you know, only really rich people would even do the train trips from, you know, New York to Chicago or Los Angeles or San Francisco, right? That these are, even if you lived in the big city, it's so fascinating to see how different we think of a big city in our modern world compared to even how we thought of it in the 70s, where it was a thing that was decaying, as opposed to like, yeah, let's come here now because this is where all the bustle is.
But a big city was also representative of being plugged into your community. Like, you couldn't be a mover and shaker and not be in a big city. The idea of being in rural nowhere and being able to shape worlds around you wasn't possible in a pre-internet era. And now all of a sudden your physical location doesn't matter at all. What matters is your virtual real estate. Like, increasingly, and maybe this is more of an after things topic, but I think about like the properties that we're building on YouTube as being physical real estate that have value. People buy and sell those channels and they generate so much traffic. And I don't know, I'm back to your metaphor, Justin, of Blade Runner is alive and well and right on time in November 2019, just not in the physical space that we thought it would be.
Let me throw out a story that's sort of kind of interesting, and we've talked about this a little before. One of the growing problems in Japan right now is Japan has a population where 20% of its population is aged 70 and older. Birth rate's been declining, and so I think they're at or they're below replacement value. So basically they're not replacing. And a lot of times people are like, oh, it's a great goal. I'm like, maybe. But the problem is everybody gets older and there's not young people to take care of the older people. And you end up, one of the problems, one of these unforeseen consequences, empty houses everywhere. That's a big problem in Japan, is they have these ghost houses, which are houses are just left abandoned. Nobody wants to take ownership of them. Other family members don't because of the taxation, et cetera. And, you know, the houses start to get under disrepair, and et cetera. And so, you know, and that's kind of something that will start happening elsewhere too, you know, because as other populations start to age out.
On top of that, like we talked about in the Boston Dynamics subjects before, I mean, that's part of why people are looking at buying these caretaking robots to walk around mm-hmm. and help you out with all of these things.
You know, I think the population thing is fascinating in Japan, and part of it is also tied to some decisions they've made about naturalization and immigration, which they're very stringent on. But, you know, I don't know. They're a very careful culture, I've noticed, by watching Terrace House, and I state confidently.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and I guess it's a point to say it's going to spread to elsewhere. You know, this is going to be a global phenomenon, you know, if we, you know, don't have a high replacement value. To the idea of, you know, technology to sort of assist as we become an older population, we just had Google buying Fitbit. And that's because you look at Apple and the Apple Watch and how that's becoming a really growing, you know, service and brand for them. And the idea of like having that personal device that first starts as health, but then it becomes a medical device. And as you get older, you know, it becomes more attractive.
Yeah, I've got complicated feelings about Google buying Fitbit, because, of course, as people know, I am an unrepentant lover of my Pebble Time Steel that I still wear to this very day with my original Kickstarter-backed edition. It continues to be the best in terms of battery life and simplicity of notifications and all that stuff. And I had hoped that when Fitbit bought Pebble, we would start to see sort of a Pebble 2.0. But it seems like they're not going in the directions I was hoping they were. But now, all of a sudden, I feel this very visceral reaction at the idea of Google, these merchants of all my private most data that selling it to the highest bidder or whatever. I was hopeful that at some point Fitbit would have an awesome Pebble 2.0, but now I don't even know. Like, I have ethical quandaries about buying anything from Google that's gonna have all of my health data on it.
I think there was a big question on whether or not this was more of a hardware play or more of a data play for Google. And when you hear reportedly that Facebook was also very much in on this. And not to say that Google and Facebook don't do hardware. They certainly do. And specifically, you know, most recently, Andrew can attest to the fact that Facebook put out maybe a best-in-class VR experience that has a great following to it. But I'm with you, Brian. I think that there is a very interesting Rubicon that we have crossed, where now the average consumer is thinking about this kind of stuff. Is thinking about micro-targeting, is thinking about how ads serve to them. and both Facebook and Google are unrepentant ad sales companies.
And keep in mind, this is not an exaggeration to say that they will have business plans that involved, hey, if somebody has this watch, we will know when they've finished their meal. And we, per our marketing research, has shown that this is when they will be the most fatigued. This is when they have the least amount of resistance to marketing messages. And we will intentionally display those ads at that exact moment with the intention of getting you better return on investment. And we're going to do it without any kind of expectation that or care about whether it's a good idea or a bad one.
See, and that to me is not that far from the blaring billboards in your face in Blade Runner's vision of the future, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we're already there. What concerns me more about Google or Facebook or anybody owning health data is, forget HIPAA law. I mean, your health data is going to be out there. And we've already had problems with companies, you know, firing people, retiring them early, doing things because they found out
retiring them early, like Blade Runner.
Finding out about health problems that they're like, oh, we don't want liability, or we don't want to pay for the insurance, these kind of things. I mean, you know, Google and Facebook, who sell their information to the highest bidder, that's a serious concern that we should all have about our health data. The privacy of it is going to go away.
I think all of this is valid, and I'm usually the guy that's like, Google this, Facebook and the data and all this. I will give you an alternative, more benevolent sort of thing, though, to think about is, because Brian, you're the second person 24 hours to mention to me who was an owner, owned one of these products that's now owned by Fitbit, who's now says, I don't think I want to make the jump to Google. But a big part of the revenue may be from the services side, and the idea that we will sell you this device, and then for $5 a month, $6 a month, we're going to sell you the health services or whatever. Because I think that's where a big part of where they're trying to grow into is that I think they're kind of close to is squeezing a lot of ad dollars out of they can to get available advertisers. I mean, there'll always be ways to improve on that. But a next big sector of growth that they're all looking at is everybody's launching services. And I could see that. I think Fitbit launched like they had like a subscription service now. And you go look at their website and you see they're trying to sell plans to health companies and stuff. So I think it's more a services play than a data play. But that doesn't rule out that it's also going to be a huge data play.
Well, and keep in mind also, let's say even if they did want to roll out a service that you would subscribe to, Google has some rehabbing to do on their reputation when it comes to protecting individuals' data. You could roll your eyes when Apple at least says that, hey, we understand your privacy is paramount to us. That's why we charge so much for our hardware. We want to protect your privacy. But at least they're even saying it, whereas Google, not so much.
Well, also,
Facebook. I mean, Google and Facebook both have problems with privacy, big problems. Well,
the difference between those three companies is that if you go to Google and you say, hey, can I buy something that involves micro-targeted data? They've got plenty of ways for you to do it. Same with Facebook. If you go to Apple and say, hey, how can I pay you money to trade on the data? There's not that similar. Now, maybe going forward, they loosen that, but they used to have an ad sales company. They'd since kind of depreciated it, and that's the direction that they feel that they want to go in.
Disclosure, keep in mind I'm a total hypocrite on this. Like we have Facebook pixels on scam stuff. We've occasionally run targeted ads through Facebook to try to reach, you know, our customers who over the last 6 months have done it. I mean, there's a reason that all of these are best practices in the world of business, but that doesn't make me feel any less weird about the whole thing.
And also, like, yeah, there's no, for anybody who's like, oh, get rid of micro-targeting ads. Like, that's really what people want, Twitter. That's really what people want, Facebook. It's like, that's the product. That's what they do. There is no them without that. Like, have ability. Like, and also, they solved a problem. They solved a problem in the marketplace. Display ads were inherently unreliable and untrackable. And so what their big pitch was, look, we can sell you data based on that. Now, I do think that it's not inconceivable to me that there's another shoe to drop, specifically considering how fast and loose Facebook has been with their analytics on other things, that maybe those numbers aren't what they seem to be. But make no mistake, these companies do not exist. And I do think that there is a realm in our world where you can say, hey, did you previously visit this site? Maybe you would like to buy this thing. That seems to me a little less creepy than some of the more advanced versions of this.
And here's the interesting thing that I came across actually in writing Simon Says. You know, I was doing a lot of ride-alongs with police because it's a detective story set in 2029. And so I was looking at a lot of technology. And some of the technology I made up for the book is actually real now for the police, ironically. So one of the things that I asked them about a lot was, you know, and I'm thinking also of the TV show Person of Interest, which kind of explored this theme, how much data and how do they balance respecting people's privacy with getting the information, you know, for modern law enforcement? Because it's a real problem between all the cameras that are all over the streets and traffic cams and everything that record all kinds of data to their databases, you know, they're all connected into with the National Criminal Information, you know, computer system at the FBI to any number of other things. How much, you know, how do you balance privacy law with doing police work? And it's complicated, and there aren't really good answers for that. The more this data gets out there, the more an issue is how much you're going to be compromised by just the fact that people know way too much about you and what you're doing.
I want to ask you about your world building, but let's first you know, there will be no weird things in the world without your support.
Absolutely, Andrew. And that's why you need to head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings. That's where you can support this show. Kick us a few dollars and we will deliver for you each and every week right here on twitch.tv/nightattacklive and in your podcast feeds. If you become a patron right now, then you're going to get our After Things podcast where we talk about the business of being a creative and an entrepreneur before anybody else. And if that's lesson number one, if you want to be a creative entrepreneur, get the information you need before anyone else, and you can do it at patreon.com/weirdthings. Thanks to everybody who supports us.
Speaking of target ads, no, I'm just kidding. Anyway.
So Mr. Schmidt, let's talk about you in writing a book that's set 10 years in the future. You have to make certain choices about world building, whatnot, what that future is going to be like. How did you decide to go for what you think is going to be, or what suits your story? What was your strategy?
I kind of got a mix of both. For example, the device that's real now that I was talking about a minute ago, that I kind of thought I was making up, was one of the guys told me, one of the cops, that, oh, one of the gags that I play on certain crooks is I put their thumbprint on my cell phone and tell them I'm getting their fingerprint and I'm running it right now. Scares the hell out of them, right? Well, now they can actually do that, okay?
Yeah.
So I created a system in my book I call Prints, P-R-I-N-T-Z, where basically the cops were able to do that. Well, now it's real. It's not quite at the cell phone level. They actually have to have a special fingerprint reader that they bring out to the scene, but they can literally get fingerprints on the spot. A lot of the technology that I'm talking about is technology that either they have or they're on the verge of. The cops often talk to me about what's coming and what's going to be going and what they'd like to have. And I put a lot of that in it too, to try to envision, you know, because, you know, in modern crime fighting, you know, the biggest battle is to stay ahead of the crooks. So whatever technology, you know, the crooks have, they got to be a step ahead. So they're always trying to come up with new technology. It's kind of like, it's just as much of a race as, like, you know, the laptop that you're using that from a year ago is already out of date. I mean, it's just that kind of tech race where they're always coming up with the new stuff. And then how do they, you know, afford it and get it in the hands of officers and who needs it? All those kind of things. So I used all of that in my thinking about the future.
Yeah, that's been, you see in law enforcement, you see some of the technology they have was something that was requisitioned like 10 years ago. And by the time it makes it into offices and cars and stuff, we're like, man, is that a Pentium 2? You know, this seems a little bit slow. And mobile fingerprint scanners, and sometimes you get the big versions of the stuff. And those have been around for about a decade. But, you know, the idea of getting down to the small portable one, and that's where it does get scary, is that the things that we take for granted in the hands of law enforcement, you know, which could be useful.
Well, it has to be, they have to police themselves. They have to monitor it carefully. And there are very good programs for that. at least in the KCPD, which is who I worked with on this, Kansas City Police Department. I mean, I'm sure there are departments that don't have that, and certainly some of the smaller towns where they don't have all the infrastructure done. But, you know, this is a state-run department. Kansas City Police Department is the only department in the state of Missouri that's actually owned by the state. They're not responsible to the city. They're responsible to the state. It's a weird setup, but it was set up years ago. So, you know, there's a lot of things that they get and also controls that come into play because they're part of the state rather than a city. So the state is like, you know, complying with a lot of, you know, concerns and issues that the city may not be at yet. So it's, I mean, I'm always trying to think of cool things that we can come up with that are, you know, fun, while at the same time, I'm paying attention to what's developing in the city. What are they about to do? What are they trying to do? What do people want to see that, you know, I can kind of just extrapolate that's happening and trends and all those kind of things. It's complicated, but I spent, I spent four to six years ago. This book was done 4 years ago and I revised it again before I put it out. So, I mean, I've had a long period of time to work on this.
Well, that's it. I would say that one thing now is I brought up at the beginning, we're talking about, hey, this is the age of Blade Runner. To me, it's like the age of the future. And Brian pointed out, like, you know, you see a thing in there, like this weird techno gadget. Nothing will surprise us now. You know, like literally it'd be really hard to sort of, you'd have to like fast them, like, you know, a real on anti-gravity or teleportation are kind of the things that would surprise me. Just about anything else now, like, I don't know. You know, we watch videos of like what, you know, there's been faked videos that look like Boston Dynamics robots, you know, like, you know, firing guns and stuff. And you realize it's CGI, but we're like, yeah, but you could have an anthropomorphic robot firing a gun right now. And we wouldn't be like, that can't happen. And so, you know, we are kind of in this age of the future, man. Bryce is good.
Those are CGI.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. I never heard that.
See?
I'll tell you what's wild.
I thought their gun safety was ridiculously irresponsible, though.
Yeah.
So I wondered about it because I was like, man, their gun safety, these people are idiots. Yeah.
I'll tell you what's wild for me to consider is the idea that there are crimes that don't yet exist that I'm certain will be created. Stuff like, for example, the intentional gaslighting of someone with the intent to radicalize them into taking violent action. I don't believe that is a crime just yet, but I don't see any reason that it wouldn't become a crime in the next 10 years. If you could make a case like, yeah, you manufactured these 375 deep fake videos that told a false narrative that created this false reality around someone and then placed them in a situation to make this very poor decision and causing this level of either economic harm or physical harm. Man, that's pretty wild. I hadn't even considered having to invent new crimes.
It's not that hard to disenfranchise people these days. You've got the doxing thing going on. You've got swatting going on. And
but like doxing is a weird one because that's the reverse of, like, it used to be there was no such thing as doxing because there was the white pages. It's like, yeah, of course, I have an address. I have a phone number. Here's how to reach me if you want to get a hold of me. And now all of a sudden it's a crime to do the service that used to be, well, you know, thrown on your doorstep.
When we talk about doxing, you got to kind of broaden to say that there is the, yes, you can find it, but versus like what you talked about when somebody says, here's Brian's address, everybody, it would be a shame if people went outside of his house. And I'd say that's the big difference, which still not a crime, but, you know, the intent.
They're singling people out for reasons that are, you know, we don't like you because you did this or you believe this different than us, and trying to publicly humiliate them, trying to cause them a lot of suffering and difficulty that can disenfranchise people, make them angry and lead to the kind of thing you're talking about. That's already a step in that direction is all I'm saying. And so, I think that, you know, you're going to the next level with this whole fake video thing and all that kind of stuff. And I think it's coming. My point is the intent to do that is very strong right now. It's already out there.
Yeah, so Mr. Schwood, in your scenario, at what point would free speech laws prevent that from being a crime or be changed or what? And like one of the things I love about our country is we don't have laws about hate speech. And the reason I love that is because a problem when you have a hate speech law, somebody gets to decide what that is. And that's when these things break. And I'm like, yeah, I'm all for hate speech. If I get to decide what it is, then it's like, well, no. So, you know, would that be a limit against that, or would we work our way around it?
Well, and I think similar to the hate speech conundrum is you have ultimately it's like, does somebody knowingly falsify someone else's perception of reality? And of course, then that, you know, you have to show intent in that case.
Yeah.
So well, in other words, I don't have an answer for you. That is a sticky one.
The thing though, is it's really important to understand that where the boundary really is saying whatever you want to say, no matter how nasty or distasteful it might be to other people, that's still free. We are protecting that. When you call for harm or do something with that speech that causes people to actually be harmed or encourages people to do harm, then it becomes a crime. That is a whole different thing.
Well, sure, yeah.
Race, or you're talking about, you know, sexual orientation in a way and saying these people are awful and I wish they'd all die, that's horrible, but it's not a crime. When you're saying,
in the U.S.,
find your neighbor who is like this and kill them, that's a different thing.
Well, yeah, but that's as old as shouting fire in a theater, right? Like there have always been limitations on free speech when it comes to directing or.
Sure, but the complication is that you shout fire in a theater, only the people in the theater hear it. Now the theater is the entire world because we have the internet. And yeah. It's instant. So, I mean, that complicated.
Yeah.
Well, now we get into the really squirrely area. Like over in Europe, they have the legislation, the right to be forgotten legislation that says basically if somebody Googles your name, you don't deserve to be defined by what one mob said about you about one tweet at that one time. And that's one that I really go back and forth on, because on the one hand, I think it's insane. There's like, no, if you said a thing, it's a fact that you said the thing, and it's not on Google to hide that from the world. But on the other hand, human beings are human beings, and sometimes stuff gets misrepresented, and it would be a bummer. You know, you're Justine Sacco's of the world who made one comment, and then that's just going to be the definition of them for the rest of their professional life. And I guess at this point we're veering dangerously close into the whole discussion about cancel culture, but there is a discussion that needs to be had. Like, is there, some people say, oh, what's the big deal? They're just losing their job. They'll go get another job. But on another level, at a human level, as tribal beings, exile equals death. And for someone to try to orchestrate a mob to exile someone from a community and to place upon them a black mark that will follow them forever to where they can never work in their same field again. They're just, their reputation is destroyed. It does feel like something tangible happened to them.
Raise your hand if you've never said anything stupid in your younger days.
I will not admit to anything.
My problem with it is this. My problem with it is this. There's not a one of us who hasn't said something stupid that they regretted or something that they've changed their mind about 10 years, 15 years ago. If we're able to just arbitrarily go back and find anything objectionable now that somebody said in the context of 15 years ago and ruin people's lives, there's a problem with that.
Well,
there's a lot of things that fall into that category.
Yeah, but my issue with the right to be forgotten is that I can understand sort of the humane reasons we want that, because you take like Justine Sacco as a person, you made one flippant sort of content, you know, comment that all of a sudden, and then you had a media group in part with group we could talk about. Those people, when they now want to play victim, but they did a malicious thing to this person, the outsized to that. But the other, my problem with it is like, hey, if I had a habit of being shoplifting and got arrested a few times and there were articles written about this, and I'm like, hey, I want those things pulled because I'm a new person now.
So what you're saying is you think there should be kind of a social credit system to kind of, you know, preserve your reputation.
There is a difference between a government enforced social credit system versus the idea that if I'm upset that somebody ripped off an employee, ripped off from me or stole from me, whatever, should I be able to write a blog post about it and talk about this experience? We'd say, sure. But if you then get into a system where you're saying, no, we need you to pull that now. And I'm like, well, now you're policing my speech. You know, I have, you know, that's.
There's a difference between a pattern of a behavior. You're talking about a pattern of crime that somebody committed. That's one thing. Somebody making one isolated comment 15 years ago, if you find them making that comment over several, you know, years, even more recently, that's similar, that's proof that this is who they are, as opposed to who they were.
Well, either way, my point is, I don't think we should be in the business of trying to, if some, you know, the post, the thing or whatever, somebody expressing a point of view on somebody else that may be negative or be positive. I think we all have that right to say that. And when we try to say, no, we're going to make these things disappear from the internet, that bothers me, because where is the line? Where does it stop? You know, once you start stepping out, it's free. My free speech is to write articles, to have a newspaper and talk about this stuff. And if I want to index and make this available to me, it's like, yeah, I it may be unfair or uncool that other people, that stuff is out there, but that's the way it works. I mean, I don't want to live in a world where we start trying to, you know, erase memories.
Well, having been through some online crap like this, let me just tell you, I've never tried to erase anything I've said, but I certainly think that people ought to do a little bit more due diligence of finding out who you are now as opposed to who you were then, because people change. I'm a way different person than I am 10 years ago when I heard sci-fi, or 15 years ago. I'm a way different person. I have different beliefs. A lot of things have changed. I've learned a lot in life, too. So I think that the problem is people are taking an isolated thing out of context, saying this is who somebody is, and it's not necessarily a fair representation of what they might say now.
I agree. I think we're eventually going to accumulate enough crap about all. God knows if somebody wanted to go through our podcast, which will soon be indexable in Google and all that. You know, the real Andrew Maine is going to be very apparent and out there. And you know, I'll be like, no, I'm a new guy, and we're all going to have enough stuff out there. I think eventually.
It's over. It's over.
We're going to listen to your podcast on our Fitbit now. You know,
that's a. I've always said that it's not an if, it's a when.
It is
as we all continue to move along. That, like, especially considering the nature of the kind of entertainment that I've treasured in my youth, and I tried to build a career making, like, plenty of landmines that I've stepped in that I would not step in now, largely because I learned that lesson of, like, oh, that wasn't funny, or that I didn't feel good after that. And it's the only hope I have is that by that point there is at least an understanding of, oh wait, we've seen this movie a lot. We've seen hero gets puffed up, a moment is revealed, we can now predict it. Like, and there's a playbook on how to handle it, by the time that it comes for us all.
Well, hell, you already had to go to surgery and get a new foot because you blew it up on the landmine. So, I mean, there's something to be said for that too.
Sure.
it is interesting. I heard somebody, I want to say it was maybe on Sam Harris's podcast, suggesting that, you know, we're in the middle of a podcasting boom, and it was suggested that maybe part of the reason podcasts are so popular right now is specifically because everybody has become so guarded in what they say in social media, because it's just a landmine, a minefield, as you know, wade into various, you know, identity politics and what have you. But meanwhile, in a podcast, at least in order to hear those words, you have to wade 45 minutes in before you get to those interesting topics. And Bryce, as a matter of fact, has pulled up some upcoming news that I wonder if that'll shape the world of podcasts.
Yeah, so there's a new thing in Apple Podcasts now where they, for selected podcasts, it's probably like a size gate, they will actually do some amount of transcription of your episodes. And so I've seen where other big podcasts have made a bit out of, like, searching through Apple Podcasts for, like, bits or, you know, phrases like the turtle that cries like a man, and their podcast shows up at top, and it's the episode that it's from. You know, the searching and transcription stuff is becoming very cheap and getting very good.
I just realized that means that we're on the cusp of, what, 10 years ago, it was a big deal. A lot of mid-level celebrities were creating Google alerts for their own names because somebody would write a little article or a snippet or mention in a comments or whatever. And then all of a sudden that famous person would swoop in. Now, for good or for ill, you'll be able to do that with podcasts to find out if anybody casually mentions your name or your podcast. Yeah.
Google's been doing this since early this year, and that's what I was talking about before. Their program is they're going to build this out, and basically, because that's the new, it's that, where's this data they don't quite have access to? Podcasts have been opaque, and now by doing the transcriptions and mentions, and then, you know, doing their own metrics, like, yeah, it's all out there, guys. Every one of your episodes of Night Attack, everything like this, all of it's going to be out there. We're going to get the dirt on you.
It's gonna age well.
It's been there forever, right? You know?
It's been there forever, but we live in a culture now where a reporter just pulls up your Twitter to try to see the dumb thing you said.
Oh, 100%.
But it's just Robert Young podcast, and then look up the word Albanian.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, 100%. And this has always been the laziest form of journalism ever. If there's one black mark on this decade as we round it out in terms of its contributions to journalism, much of which is very, very important and we should pay attention to, is the something happened on TV. And now I'm going to get a blog post by going on Twitter and searching awful words and then finding out whether or not some Yahoo on a totally unregulated social media site indeed said an awful, horrifying phrase while something important was happening on television. It is no effort. It is lazy. And it is highlighting just the worst element of humanity for nothing but cheap clicks.
The other problematic element of it is the idea that your triggers are my responsibility. I mean, that's a debate we're going to have, and that's problematic too. I can't walk around and know what your triggers are if I don't know you. So if you're going to be offended by something I say, it's really more on you than me to a degree to learn how to deal with that. Going around and getting offended by anybody and everybody who says something that doesn't even know you, I mean, There are minefields you walk in you don't even know is a minefield, and most people wouldn't even think was a minefield. That's also part of the problem.
Do you think it's possible that we can see positive nudges from your Googles or your Apples or whatever, that nowadays we're able to have conversations, full-on conversations back and forth through translation engines, where maybe it doesn't translate everything exactly perfectly, but we're at least able to come to an understanding between two parties not speaking the same language. Do you think that there could be a plug-in that sort of, you know, somebody says something, this engine has detected that this may be an incendiary phrase to you, hover over it to get a context on it and what this person, his background is and what he likely meant if it was phrased differently. Do you think there's any hope for that kind of thing to happen?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's where we're going. Look, I was just thinking about the fact that people would dictate whole novels with Dragon software. And OCR, which 10 years ago was part of my job and was not very good, but look at what it can do now. They're going to just be running those podcasts eventually through like a Dragon-type software that'll do all the transcription for it. They won't have to have a person sitting in a room doing any of it. And it will, you know, eventually they'll make it so that it doesn't get that much wrong. Right now it'd get a lot of things wrong and humans have to correct it, or you just have to live with the errors being in there. And I think you're going to absolutely get to the point where you literally can have like Google prompts that go through and give you cross references of the text that's subtitled on the screen as you speak it. And
so
how much of that is really helpful? I don't know.
So my question is, that was sort of the whole hypertext dream, was the idea that within a document you could find out more and dig more and get nuance and all that. But how many people really want that or just want to be offended?
Well,
and part of that is how much do you want to actually have to spend that much time censoring yourself so you can't even speak, be who you are.
I wouldn't mind if everybody spent much more time censoring themselves. That seems to be like a universally good thing. If we all took a little bit of time, and as a matter of fact, I would, and again, I'm not talking about clamping down on free speech, just nudges, like Twitter saying, hey man, it looks like you fired off 3 tweets all in a row. In general, more people than you would expect end up regretting that. Are you absolutely certain you want to continue to engage in this behavior? Check yes, no. That these words...
Being thoughtful is one thing. Being thoughtful is important. Automatically having to check every word that comes out of your mouth before you say it and changing what you're going to say and changing your voice, in effect, that's what I'm worried about.
Well, there is a... language, speech, communication is constantly evolving. There's no reason that we should assume that is not that's not happening at a more accelerated pace, the more that we're able to communicate with each other. And we do have a tremendous clash of cultures, not only internationally, obviously, is probably the broadest way that we can look at it, but also regionally. We live in a very, very expansive country that has many different subcultures within it that now all of a sudden all operate on this very jumbled mismatch of what we assume to be a level playing field. That being said,
generationally too.
Of course. Yeah, that as well. That being said, I do think that there is a way that we will be able to guide ourselves going forward, if even just to re-silo. I think that the thing about social media that was amazing was that for the first time, a very lonely space on the internet. I go to the same message boards. I talk to the same people. I go to the same websites. There's a limited cross-section between the people that I interact with in my actual daily life with the people that are on these sites. Now all of a sudden hit a tipping point where we were all able to do it. And now there was a cross current of everybody being able to speak to each other. And the fact that, did you hear Brad was canceled on Twitter? Now that actually has currency in your real life because people know what those things are. And we have a crumbling ad infrastructure for media that then incentivizes them to hunt for whatever clicks there are. And that plugs into social media and we get a dovetail. So I hope that there is, I've always clung to this, and this might be my last dying words as I'm burned in the ashes of, I flutter away in the ashes after Pompeii happens. But I do think that we are in an adolescent era and there will be at least some level beyond the chaos. And I hope that we are getting closer to there and not continuing to flee into our Blade Runner future.
I imagine like the first person who figured out like writing wrote on the stick onto the ground and sketched it out. And, you know, Justin comes along. What is it? Oh, it's just Justin smells like poo. Ah, why would you do this? I'm going to write something out. I'm getting a stick and I'm writing things too now. And somebody's like, we got to take away sticks, guys. This is causing problems.
But I can totally see, just like the guy who defuses beefs that you have with somebody who you just met, and then maybe he's friends with both of you. He's like, hey, hold on. I know the guy didn't come across well. He misspoke. Look, you guys both like the Mets. You both like this. Whatever. And then you're like, okay, you provisionally decide to let it go. I think I would trust an AI with that. Hey, I've gone back. This person culturally identifies very similar to you. You have an 85% crossover. For whatever reason, it seems like he spoke poorly on this, and that as your AI advisor, probably not worth it to twist nipples over this one thing. But instead, you guys both like Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. So you have a chance to get back to civility.
I like this idealistic idea. I do. But like, I remember when I realized, I was an atheist and I got involved with atheist groups. I'd be sitting there and be like, yeah, we need to do something about Christmas. I'm upset when I walk into a store and I hear about Christmas. And I'm like, I like Christmas, And like, and then like, well, this holiday display here about Christmas. I'm like, ah, it's cool. This is great. And then I'm like, it's angry. It's upsetting to me. And I'm like, and now I don't know. It was like they wanted to be upset. And I don't know how that AI fits in there. If people don't, because like I'm like, I believe the same stuff you guys do. But like, holy cow, like you want to be offended.
There's also the people who's, it's always been a problem with technology or free speech both, who refuse to use it responsibly. There's always going to be the people that are just like, screw it. I'm going to say whatever the hell they want. And I love pissing people off and I love causing conflict. And it, no matter what AI they get, they'll be like, oh, so I shouldn't say that. That's exactly what I'm going to say. I mean, that's just and we have to, at a certain point, identify who those people are and react differently to them than we do to other people, I think, in a sense. I mean, if we're going to get away from the chaos.
I want Brian's AI companion. I would use that.
I'm with you, Brian, but I do think that there is an evolutionary shift that kind of has to happen for us societally. And this is what it is. The tech platform side will never save us. We're never going to have Facebook or Twitter or anything else be able to algorithmically change how our behavior is. They're never every moment that they try to mold it in a certain direction. We will always find a way to get exactly what we want out of that platform, whether or not they want us to do that exact thing. I do think we could have a future is on more of the personal side. If we are looking at, hey, you want to know what? Maybe I'm going to spend a larger amount of money on a personal AI that is now mine and it doesn't transmit to anybody. And it's effectively as secure as my inner monologue. And it is just trying to make me better. And I trust it. And I want it to be my personal trainer. I want it to be my life coach. I want it to be these things that I'm already going to go out and pay money for. That's where I think that we can have a future. And I do think that
part of this is also we got to have a more responsible understanding of what these things are. And I don't think that our generation ever functionally will, because it's still magic. It's still this thing that popped up when we were either in our adulthood, childhood, or teenage years. And we will always have this different reaction to it. And I've never felt more on the other end of a generational divide. Last night, Ashley and I were watching, of all things, TikTok. And TikTok will automatically just feed you the popular things that are happening right now. One out of every three is just a teenager confessing how sad they are, right? Just saying, hey, I like this boy. This boy doesn't like me back. Hey, I'm stupid and I didn't study for a test and I feel like my father doesn't like me, right? And some of them are funny. Some of them are just out and out confessionals. But I was startled by the idea of like, man, when I was a kid, I had to internalize that and just draw skulls repeatedly on my notebook cover until somebody noticed that I was depressed. Like they get rewarded. It is part of cultural currency to say, I'm sad. I'm very sad right now, and I don't like how my body looks, and I'm sad about my scoliosis. And I'm like, that's the most healthy thing that I have ever seen in my entire life, that we're rewarding. Enough people are liking it that it's being fed algorithmically to me, a 35-year-old, as they're saying, this is obviously the most popular content on the platform. It gave me the most hope I'd ever had for the youth of our world.
Well, and the reality is that you know, people, just because it's available doesn't mean people are going to opt to use it. And so the technology in its coolness and our excitement over it is always going to outpace the sense of how it's appropriate to use it, how it's responsible to use it, and so on and so forth, and any appropriate regulations that might be put on it. I mean, we're always going to have those periods where it comes along and all of a sudden it's become, you know, it's creating problems that we never anticipated.
We yelled at Facebook because, you guys should be censoring some of this stuff. And then they hired people to watch videos and they're like, why are you making people watch those videos? They're horrific. They're being traumatized by this. I'm like,
You're talking about for the what do they call it? The standard quality standards or whatever?
Yeah,
the violence or whatever. I mean, people are, there's all these stories that are out about the, you know, factories of underpaid workers that are having to monitor all this Facebook content.
I, 24 hours a day,
who have PTSD and all these problems.
I met somebody, a friend of a friend was a contractor for YouTube, and her job literally every day was just to mow through the flagged content. And among them, that is the worst of the worst, right? So she's just watching, imagine the worst thing that could be posted on the internet. That and then times three, because the people that are posting it have been thinking about this for a very long time and they are hunting for it and they are doing awful things and they are spreading it. It's awful, right? But then at the same time, you have to because you need to protect these standards and practices. That's before we even get to, this is politically objectionable. This is a bullying. This is any of the, like, you know, balls and strikes. Maybe we should have this on the platform. Maybe we shouldn't. This is just straight out beheading videos and worse.
Yeah. All right. We can go to worse or we go to better, but let's go to picks.
Yeah.
Dude, we'll go to better. In fact, a lot of what we've been talking about sort of touched on in the new Malcolm Gladwell book, Talking with Strangers, I believe it's called. Really enjoyed it. I just finished it this morning. I love... First of all, the content is good, as Malcolm Gladwell, but also Talking to Strangers, that's the name of it. He also makes it a little bit closer to a podcast. He, at the beginning of the audiobook, says, hey, normally in an audiobook, somebody's just reading everything to you. In this case, whenever there's a quote and we have the original audio, I'm just going to play the original audio for you. So it'll be a little bit more like an enhanced podcast, which I enjoyed quite a bit. It doesn't have a terribly strong thesis the way some of his previous books do, but it did get me into a thoughtful place about social discourse and how we treat other human beings.
Well, a strong thesis can sometimes be the enemy when a few years later they find out it's been completely debunked. So there's that. But
you're really optimistic. Thank you for that.
No, I love Gladwell. He's a wonderful Tory, but that was one of the things. I remember one of his books that came out, like, turned out this study not what we thought it was, and you're like, it was such a good book, you know. But then you're like, that's cool. But he's actually got a master class right now too on writing, which he's controversial in certainly some sectors, but like I think as a guy who's really good at blending science or psychology and storytelling, he is amazing.
Yeah,
at that.
It seems like much like Elon Musk's number one sin is just tardiness on deliverables. It seems like Malcolm Gladwell's sin tends to be oversimplification. That doesn't.
There are in some cases there's taking things that were later debunked, but not wanting to go back or revise that, or at the time that was he found a narrative, but it was. It worked as a narrative. Maybe it wasn't reality. You know, we can get into a bigger discussion about that, but
The
observation is fine, but there's been several issues like his Pitbull study says like, no, this is, we flat out don't think that's the case anymore, but he's adamant about, no, this is the thing. And it's like, all right, he's an amazing writer. And so,
and there we go. I think that's the Malcolm Gladwell point. He's a great synthesizer. He's a great storyteller. He's a great writer. If you really want to get into the stuff, look up more of it. That's the beautiful thing about the world, is that he can be the gateway drug to get you involved in a lot of these ideas. My pick, and we'll stay on the philosophy train, the new season of The Good Place, which I'm very, very interested in where it's going, because part of what they are dealing with in this season is dealing with people that you find odious and awful and a general terrible part of the universe. And I'm curious to see how they are going to wrap up this, the final season. But I think it is something that is very rare in the world of 30-minute comedies, thought-provoking and interesting.
It's a delightful show in that you know, bringing up philosophy, bringing this, we're up to date on the episodes, and it really won me over. You guys were talking about it, and I was skeptical. I'm like, how wonderful is it in this day and age that we have a show that gets into the basics of ethics and why we're good or bad to each other and whatnot? And so I will
bring it up. I'll bring up this episode since we do have a few authors here on the show, but the most recent episode involves one of the characters writing a putridly terrible book, but then the idea being like, all right, everybody's, you know, very understandably mean to him because he says, you know, a bunch of awful things in the book, but then he wrote a book. Where do we come down on that? Yeah, and because of the stakes set up within the show, I think that there are some interesting conversations that not only take place on it, but also come out of it.
Other picks?
I'm going to go retro. I just read for the first time the Jaws log, which is a log by the screenwriter of Jaws of the making of the film. And it's been updated.
Wow.
It was updated 25 years later. So it was, you know, updated recently. And he, you know, it's really one of the best written, like, making of film memoirs I've ever read. It really gets into depth on a whole lot of things about filmmaking, but just the whole experience of it and decisions that are made and the whole process of adapting a book, which of course as an author, it's fascinating for me. And so I highly recommend it if you like to know kind of about that and everything from celebrities to behind the scenes of a movie to just the whole process of adapting material to different medium, all of that. And, you know, a lot about the art of collaboration, which is more than any other art form, filmmaking is collaborative on a big, huge level. So I think that I highly recommend that. I also, on the subject of film, want to bring up Rashi's film, Dark Passage, which is a little short film that you can find on Andrew's Twitter. But I was really impressed with her ability to tell a story in a very short amount of time. The thing's only like 2 or 3 minutes long max, and she tells a little 3-act horror story that really well. I gotta say, it's not that easy to do that in that short time frame. So if you like, it's simple, but you know, it's got nuance, and I would recommend y'all take a look at it.
Yeah, that's overstating the runtime. It is a 1-minute horror film. And
is it only 1 minute? Okay, I couldn't remember. I was being generous, but you know, yeah.
Yeah.
It's all the more impressive because it's only 1 minute. There you go.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah, we'll put up a link in the notes for a week, but you look up Dark Passage and then Rush Bhatia. Jesus, thank you, by the way. So, but yeah, thank you for the plug on that. Bryce, do you have a pick?
I got a quick pick. They got the new Apple TV Plus out now. Anybody's watch any of those?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't love this, but I think the morning show is pretty good. I think it's doing
it's pretty good. Question mark. Put that on the poster.
Like, yeah.
So you paid for Apple TV Plus. It's worth the money. Is that what you're saying?
No, it's free to everybody. If anybody buys any major Apple anything, everybody gets, if you're the kind of person who upgrades your iPhone every cycle, congrats, you have Apple TV Plus forever.
You get a year of Apple TV Plus when you buy most Apple hardware. So
I guess I have it then on my iPad that I'm using right now. But I looked the other day and it sounded like certain shows were going to be subscription only. So I figured I didn't have that.
Because it's in the Apple TV app. And so you have the Apple TV Plus shows alongside all the stuff that's normally in the TV app, like what you're watching on Hulu and HBO. I think the morning show is all right. It's it's about a morning show, like a Today style show. Where one of the lead anchors, Steve Carell, gets Me Too'd basically and is fired from the show. And so it follows Jennifer Aniston as she is sort of fighting for control over who she works with, and Reese Witherspoon, who is feisty is not the right word. She's
brassy gal.
She was working at a local news station and then ends up getting on the show to talk about this viral clip and then ends up on the show. And so she's kind of navigating the waters of also being an anchor and having to read what's given to her and not having a lot of producing and journalistic elements to it. So I think it's interesting. It's very much like trying to be an Aaron Sorkin thing. I mean, there are walk and talks constantly. There are tons of them. A lot of the big, like, monologuing, dramatic speeches. But it doesn't feel as hokey as some of that.
Do we find out how important the morning news is?
No, I think
the world deserves to know. Is this the most adorable poodle?
So
yeah,
that's who is the fastest eater on the planet?
Is it the smart
young female protagonist tells the older wise guy, you know, what he gets wrong in life and what he needs to be doing right to set himself straight, you know?
Okay. So there is a little bit of, but I think what's interesting is who
it's Sorkin without the Sorkin.
But I think it's kind of interesting that the balance of it is because like with the newsroom, right. It's like from episode one, it's like, we're going to do the news, right. We have decided we're going to go back to history and we're going to cover everything. Right. Where this is like, they know it's a morning show. They know that, you know, the company that they're a part of, the network that they're a part of, they know that this is in the entertainment division and not necessarily that news is a part of the entertainment division. And that's what Reese Witherspoon's character seems to want to do, is to inject more, I don't know,
hard-hitting,
real heart of journalism.
The Apple TV shows have had, we could describe, sort of a lukewarm reception, but I think that anytime you launch a new platform, God knows what it's like to be producers and writers and stuff working with hardware manufacturers and trying to figure out what your content line is going to be. I'm very hopeful that over time it's probably going to evolve into just, you know, a lot of first-rate entertainment. So
yeah, I watched the first episode of For All Mankind. I didn't pick that as my pick today.
I watched that.
Yeah. I watched 20 minutes of C this morning. That's okay. I thought that they have the first of like the Oprah's book club thing on Apple TV Plus. That seemed interesting, though. They make a very big point to talk about. Oh, we're in the I don't know the name of the library, but this historic library here in Washington D.C. that Apple renovated and is now a big Apple store. And you see the photos of the Apple store next to the historic photos, and it seems like a cool way to do that book club, but. Everyone's got phones in these series. Everyone's got the iPhone, and they know how to use it too.
In a world where Android doesn't exist,
I'm shocked at that meta information that happened. I can't believe it.
Well, it just the obviousness is, I think, what really people were, you know, kind of that it's been a thing pointed out, but
See. Well, yeah. I mean, I got to be honest with you. The way that streaming is divided up between Warner Brothers and Paramount and everybody doing their own thing, we're just going to see more of that. The more the whole product placement thing originally, you know, I remember back in the days when in the 70s and 80s when, you know, they avoided it. And now they sell placement on movies and TV shows. And when the providers control it, you know, it's only going to get worse. I mean, you know, the only thing that exists is on Warner Brothers Channel is something that Time Warner owns. I mean, that's just the way it's going to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like I was even Netflix does it. I was watching the Raising Dion show about the little kid who gets superpowers. That show's all right. And like the weird like uncle godfather guy, his ringtone is the Stranger Things like theme song. So you just hear and it's like, oh, my phone. And I'm like, oh my God.
It's cheaper for them to get the rights to that.
Yeah.
My pick is Simon Says by Mr. Brian Thomas Schmidt. Listen, if you like sci-fi, you like hard sci-fi, you like thrillers, you like this, I highly recommend you check out, you know, Brian's work and others too. Brian's been a fantastic editor. Brian's had a hand in a lot of things, very good. And now, hey, he's got a new book out, Simon Says, the John Simon thriller. So that's my pick, available on Amazon.
Thank you. I was really hopeful that your hat was not a commentary on my book.
No, I'm wearing my Boring Company hat.
I'm seeing Boring on there, and I'm thinking, oh, God, who's he criticizing? What's the subtext here?
Hey, I live in a very big glass house, Brian. So, a small glass house, but I live in a glass house. It's very fragile glass. So,
yes. I remember. I've been there.
So, yeah, I'm glad you you're getting out there, and I hope you're going to keep doing this. So, gentlemen, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this broadcast.